This is a free recording by Cambridge Cookbooks, etc. We hope you enjoy and benefit from the content. Also, please consider donating to the new Cambridge Mosque. Please visit cambridgemosqueismoving.org.uk.
رب يسر وأعين يا كريم وفي الحق إنك الفتاح العليم. I'm going to focus this talk, which will probably be quite a short one, on a principle that is inescapable, whatever we view we take of it, because one of the things that we can't avoid as social animals is engaging with others. I'm going to say a few things about that category traditionally described as a sohba, companionship, engaging with others, traditionally opposed to the principle of uzla, withdrawal, seeking solitude, and much of religion and the paradoxes of religion exist somewhere along that pole. Are we better off spiritually on our own, where there are fewer distractions, or are we better off spiritually with others, who may uplift our state and where we have the opportunity to develop akhlaq? Or, since we live in a world where things are never quite that simple, are there going to be some people whose company we seek out and other people whose company we should avoid? And even more complicatedly, what if those people who we instinctively want to avoid because they seem to be dragging us down should be the objects of our compassion, so that we actually seek them out in order to try and help them overcome the things that we find repulsive in them? So it's a principle that has exercised the sheikhs for a long time, and very often, given the messy nature of human relations, there is no straightforward and simple answer that is appropriate for every situation. But I want to focus this on a text, a risala, which is specifically about this issue of sohba, written by somebody who had deep personal experience both of sohba and of uzla. And this is somebody called Makhdum al-Mulk Sharafuddin bin Yahya Mari, known to the people of Bihar and Bengal as Makhdum Sab. And he lived before the Mughals. He's one of the early spreaders of Islam in the subcontinent. It's the 13th century. And he was the pupil of a Hanbali scholar of Delhi, and known throughout his life as a man of correctness in Sharia. We don't actually know if he was a Hanbali himself, but his teacher was a Hanbali. And we know that in keeping with the practice of the people of the time, he sought out not just teachers in fiqh, but teachers who would help him to sort out his inner relationship to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when he was in Delhi, he met the great Sheikh Nizamuddin Awliya, who at the time was a tremendous vortex of conversion to Islam and of people making tawbah on his hands. But it seems that Nizamuddin Awliya was not the one with the particular therapy or remedy that was appropriate for Makhdum Sab's heart. And so he travelled, and at some point he met somebody from a very obscure order called the Firdausiya order, somebody called Sheikh Najibuddin Firdausi. We don't know too much about them. Firdausiya largely confined to corners of eastern India, linked to the Kubrawiya of Central Asia. And he repented at his hands and spent, as far as we can tell, 10 years in a very small group and sometimes on his own in the Rajgir Mountains, which are now not far from the boundaries between Bangladesh and Bihar, coming into town only to attend the Jumu'ah prayers. And then something happens to his heart, and he moves from the state of uzla into the state of sohba, and thousands come to him from different religions, Buddhists as well as Hindus, and convert at his hands. He is one of the people who launched the Islamization process of in Bengal. It is because of men such as that that part of the world has such a substantial population of Muslims, maybe 200 million Muslims in that corner of the subcontinent. And Makhdum Saab's fame spread, and for 40 years he was teaching. Muhammad bin Tughluq, the Sultan in Delhi, was an admirer and created for him a little mosque, which you can still visit to this day in the Rajgir district. And there's a well and a cave, and you can see where he lived with his family. Those are the outward circumstances of his life, and he taught not so much through writing books, but by writing letters, which is one of the qualities of many of the sheikhs of India. You think of Ahmed Sirhindi, for instance. And his letters, his maktubat, known as the 100 letters, maktubati sadi, 100 letters, have been preserved, and they have been done into English in a nice translation from the original Persian. And what I want to do is to just offer a few reflections on, which one is it, number 70, letter number 70, where he talks about sohbah, this principle of companionship. And of course it's rooted in that paradox, which is, as it were, the paradox that frames the story of Islam before the Hijrah, the story of Islam in the period in Mecca, which begins when the angel comes to him, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, when he is in his solitude, كان يخلو بغار حراء. He was on his own, he would go on his own to the cave of Hira, and the angel came to him, جاءه الحق. And then at the end of the Meccan period, there is the other cave, the cave of Thawr, where he is now with Thani Ithnain, the second of two, Sayyidina Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, radiallahu an. And in a sense that mirrors what is taking place, that from solitude he is moving to a situation of engagement. But still it's, as the French say, a solitude à deux, solitude with just two people. And that particular spiritual relationship between Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and Sayyidina Abu Bakr is something that's going to have gigantic implications subsequently in Islamic history. So there is that, and there is also the paradoxical idea of the Ashab and the Ahbab being in a sense the same but different. And this is mirrored in a hadith which is in Tirmidhi, and the Ahbab, the beloved ones, the Sahaba ask him, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, who are these Ahbab? And he says, they are people who will come after your time, who will revive what people have neglected of my law. So there's a sense in which there can be a love, and a love type of companionship, even amongst people that one has never met. And that's again one of the paradoxes that the sheikhs talk about. Can you be a companion of somebody that you've never met and not have a proper state of sohbah, even with somebody who you might be very closely related to, somebody you might have been brought up with, but there's never been that real sense of companionship with that person? Perhaps there's been a sibling rivalry instead. This is the subtle alchemy of human souls that is linked ultimately to the alam al-arwah and the prophetic statement, الأرواح جنود مجندة فما تعارف منها تلف وما تناكر منها تلف. That souls are like marshalled armies, and those which knew each other shall be close to each other, and those which denied each other shall be at odds with each other. It's an enigmatic hadith, but it's usually interpreted by the ulama to refer to the alam al-arwah, when the souls existed with certain traits that then develop when we're enfleshed in the bodies into the humanity that we're familiar with now. There was a kind of quintessential individuality then, and there was a knowing that took place between some people, and hence the idea, very current amongst many Muslims, that this kind of chemistry that takes place between human beings is something that is the reawakening of something very ancient. That an old friend is, as it were, a very old friend, because there is a recollection of some kind of, to our rational minds, unimaginable proximity that was there in the alam al-arwah. And that's one of the asrar, one of the secrets of human relationships, that there are certain types of relationship that on the surface really don't seem to make much sense at all. And other sorts of relationship that you would expect to be very obvious, but the people just somehow can't get on. Identical twins who just can't get on for whatever reason. Or other people who are from completely different cultural, religious, ethnic groups, but immediately when they meet, they click. And sometimes we think of that most obviously in terms of romantic love. I immediately clicked with her. But it's a general human phenomenon that we do feel at ease with certain sorts of people. They're not necessarily people from our own families, language groups, racial groups, religious groups. It's just some kind of subtle human chemistry that the ulama will say may well have something to do with the disposition of the soul before birth. So these obviously are deep waters. We're way beyond sociology here, and we're talking about some of the mysteries of the human soul. And this is why the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam speaks of those whom he loves, who he has not yet seen. That there is an empathy with those people, even though they may come centuries in the future. So this is his letter number 70, and he's writing to somebody who becomes his successor after his death, Shamsuddin. So let's just listen to what he says. Letter 70, Companionship. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brother Shamsuddin, may Allah grant you the grace of good company. A very important need of the disciple is to associate with these people. Such association makes a deep impression. It is a total attack on a person's temperament and habits, to such an extent that a falcon, by associating with men, becomes wise, and a parrot learns to speak, while a horse, because it associates with men in its training, loses its animal traits and takes on those of men. There are many examples of this sort of thing. Everybody has seen and witnessed the effect of association. The phenomenon can be described under the rubric of the influence derived from associating with others. So the reason why he's interested in this is that he sees it primarily as a form of spiritual transformation. That the great issue that we have with ourselves is not how much we can learn outwardly, but how much we're capable of changing inwardly. That it is easy to get a university degree, as long as you have the adequate time management skills, but actually to turn yourself into a different sort of person, particularly if you want to be a better sort of person, is a very different kind of exercise and something that can't be learnt from studying books or from attending classes. It's something that's more subtle, something to do with the ruh itself. And the way he's attacking this subject is to say, this is how we can change it, it's through association. Look at the way in which a horse, which is naturally a wild animal charging around in the grassland, can actually become something quite different, can become tame when it associates with human beings, when it has a teacher, when its particular wild horse-like qualities are subdued, and it becomes intimate with the company of human beings. And of course we know domestic animals can be the same kind of thing. A dog can really identify with the human beings of a family, and in its sort of consciousness, it feels that it's part of the family, even though that's certainly not the natural quality of a dog, which is a pack animal that lives in the wild. But through enculturation and through associating with people, these deep-rooted temperaments and traits can be changed. So he says again, it's a total attack on a person's temperament and habits. Nothing more powerful in changing and turning around the innate deep tendencies of human beings than the kind of company we keep. And that's because the hadith says, At-tab'a salim sarraq, that a sound human nature is a thief, which means that to the extent that we are ordinary, soft-hearted, empathetic human beings, we do take on very quickly and very easily, without even thinking, the qualities of those that we're with. We take it from them whether they give their permission or not, which is why it says, is a thief. That you keep the company of people of ibadah for a certain period of time, and you become temperamentally like them. You keep the company of thieves or of heavy drinkers for a certain period of time, and you mould yourself, you're reshaped outwardly and inwardly in order to comply with them. So that's why he's a total attack on the first temperament. Nothing else quite gets to the depths of the soul than this mystery of sohbah. Association overcomes not only innate habits, but also one's created temperament. So it's not just that if you're associating with the drinkers, you get into the drinking style of life, but the actual temperament itself, the inward nature, is changing as well.
To begin with, the sheikhs seek the benefit of associating together and command their disciples to do the same. In other words, at the outset, anybody who's a spiritual beginner is like a child. How is a child going to benefit and become sort of a civilized member of society if it's on its own all the time? Even if it has parents but it has no siblings, its tendency will often be to be more egotistic and more difficult than if it's making its way amongst a peer group and siblings of its own age. Similarly, anybody who's a spiritual beginner is going to need, as a kind of axiom, the presence of others. To be alone in a directed and spiritually disciplined way is extremely difficult. It is the way of some of the awliya as a temporary measure. It was the way of Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam before the Risala in the cave of Hira. But it's a very difficult thing to carry. And the Shaykh is saying, if you're at the outset, then association with others becomes an obligatory duty. The intent of all this is to provide rest for a person's soul in whatever group he happens to be. Association relates to the ways of behavior that characterize the group, since all the group's affairs and influence develop in the context of mutual interaction. And the Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, "A man chooses the religion and path of his friend. Take note of who his associates are." Amma'u ala dini khalili, variants of this hadith, that we follow the religion of whoever we are closest to. And that doesn't mean a superficial judgment. What it means is the deep quality of the soul. That the disposition of the soul, if you actually feel more at ease with Zoroastrians than you do with Muslims, the disposition of your soul, if that's really what the soul craves and feels at ease with, is a Zoroastrian rather than an Islamic disposition. If his companions are good, then he himself, even though he is bad, will become good, because their magnanimity will affect a change in him. And this, again, is very frequently the case, and often you find that evildoers, because they know that they are potentially weak in this way and susceptible to being changed for the good, will actually very deliberately go to great lengths to avoid associating with people who might remind them of how dreadful they are. And sometimes for instance, in some of the Gulf states or in Saudi Arabia, you can engage with princes, and the worst kind of prince is the one, all of his associates turn out to be Lebanese Christians, all of the people who handle his affairs. And why is this? Because he's afraid that if he associates with Muslims too much, then maybe he'll start to feel bad about some of the things that he's doing in his private life or in his business, and he doesn't want that transformation. So he makes sure that he associates only with people who are only interested in taking money from him and not interested in any kind of judgment, and he's at ease with that. That's characteristic of the condition of the person who is routinely involved in what he knows to be a bad practice or a sin. But the thing that he most fears is association with people who are better than himself, not just for the obvious reason that they might disapprove, but because there is a risk that he's going to be taken away from his pleasures, because he might begin on the path of repentance. On the other hand, if he associates with bad companions, he too will become bad, because his situation encourages him to be satisfied with what is bad, and even though he was good, he will end up by becoming bad. And we all know this is the case with us weak human beings. Inevitably, if we keep the company of people who are really low-life types, then our manners will degenerate, then our adab will degenerate, then our practices will start to degenerate, our practice of the deen will become weaker. Everybody knows that we are weak. We do have this taba, this temperament that steals from the quality of others. So that's the second point that is made. This is why it's important, because we have this weakness and this susceptibility to being transformed and shaped as social animals by the kind of people that we're hanging out with. There is the story of a man who is making his way around the Kaaba, doing tawaf and praying, "O Allah, make my brothers good." People said to him, "You finally reached this holy place. Why do you not pray for yourself? Why are all your prayers for your brothers?" He replied, "I have several brothers to whom I shall be returning. If I find them acting virtuously, then I too will become good on account of their virtue. But if I find them steeped in wickedness, then I too will become perverted by their wickedness. Since my goodness will result from associating with good people, I therefore pray for my brothers that I might achieve my aim through their help. Which is a curious idea, but you can see the point of it. Very important to pray for the improvement of the people that you associate with, not just because that's your obligation anyway, but because by doing so you actually improve your own state, because to the extent that they're being uplifted, it's going to be good for you as well. Malik bin Dinar, one of the great imams of the Salaf, once said, "Do not associate with any brother or friend if you derive no benefit therefrom for your faith or the world to come. Such company should be considered as forbidden for you." So he's giving quite a significant and severe judgment here. If the person that you're hanging out with, your friend, is, when you think about it, not actually helping you in your Islam or in your preparation for eternity, then he says it's actually forbidden for you to keep the company of that person. That person is just going to drag you into frivolous and trivial time-wasting pursuits, and it's simply not appropriate that you should be with him. The proper way of associating with others has been thus expressed. Your associates will either be senior to you or junior to you. If you associate with your elders, you should be the one to derive some profit from their company. If, on the other hand, you associate with people younger than yourself, then they should profit from the contact and learn something from you that will deepen their faith. If you also learn something from them, then your faith too will be deepened. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, "Make many men your brothers for the sake of their good behaviour and upright dealings, for your God is full of life and bounty." I don't know the origin of that hadith, but inshallah the meaning is clear and right. It's for this reason that the Lord does not like to see his slave tormented in front of his brothers. As for the Day of Judgment, however, a person should prepare himself by associating with others for the sake of Allah, not for the sake of his own personal desires, no matter what they be. And that's something that seems to me you often lose sight of, partly because modern life is so hectic, and the modern system tries to put us to economically profitable use in such very demanding and efficient ways. That applies to the life of students as well as the life of people who are in careers and in professions. That very often what we do when we're not actually at work at the coalface is to look for people to hang out with, primarily so that we can kind of relax, chill out, and unwind. Now, we have the right to do that. We have the right to relax and to decompress. But what this text is saying is that that shouldn't really be the basic criterion which guides us in our choice of friends and companions. We shouldn't just hang out with so-and-so because we can kind of joke around and feel at ease, because we feel that we really deserve some downtime. Instead, really, we should be looking for people whose company will help us to relax and to decompress, because they're people of dhikr, inshallah. People who are actually going to improve our state. And that's really one of the differences between the conscious believer and somebody who's, as it were, just freewheeling through life. The real believer is the one who is taking a conscious decision whenever he does something of real significance, such as choosing who his friends are going to be. Are they going to improve my state? Is this not just an opportunity to relax and laugh and have a good time? Is it going to actually improve the state of my deen? Because I know I'm weak, I'm going to be influenced by this person, so what's in it spiritually for me? It has been said that being alone is deeply destructive for a novice. As the hadith says, "The shaitan dwells with the man who is by himself, but he remains at a distance if there are two together." And there are very many hadith like this. The innama ya'kulu dhi'bu min al-ghanami al-qasiya, that the wolf eats only the sheep that has stayed from the flock. And yadullahi ma'al jama'a, Allah's hand is with the company, the congregation, those who stay together. And in fact, there's no greater misfortune and nothing more dangerous than living by oneself. There was a disciple who said, "I have attained perfection. There will be no harm if I abandon the company of other people." He retired to a place by himself and lived in privacy. When night came, he saw a whole troop of people approaching him. "Be seated on this horse and come to paradise," they begged. He mounted the horse and went off. He saw a place where all was joy and pleasure, filled with handsome girls, delicious food, and running streams. He passed his time there until dawn, when he fell asleep. On waking up, he found himself at the door of his hermitage. The pride of youth manifested its influence in his heart. He began to boast, saying that he'd attained such and such a state, and was doing such and such. News of this reached the ears of his teacher, who set out and came to the door of the hermitage. He inquired about his pupil's spiritual condition. He related everything that had occurred, and the teacher said to him, "When you go to that place tonight, then repeat 3 times, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." That night he went off as usual with the group. After quite some time, he thought of what his teacher had told him to do. As an experiment, he repeated 3 times, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. They all cried out and disappeared. He found himself on a rubbish dump with bones scattered all around him. He realized his fault, and having repented of it, returned to the company of his fellow disciples. Now you can understand what a misfortune it is for a disciple to be alone. And those of you who've seen the famous film, The Saragossa Manuscript, will remember that one of the key moments is where the individual who falls asleep and dreams that he's back in the time of Moorish Spain and has these wonderful experiences actually realizes that this is a demonic insinuation that has been able to get through to him because he's been traveling alone for so long. Because he's no longer in a state of sota, as the author of this text would understand it, with human beings, the possibility of there being an unseen dochter with diabolical principles, with shayateen, becomes much, much greater, because yadullah al-jama'ah, Allah's hand is with the company, and if you're on your own, the wolf may well grab you. And very often people who spend a lot of time on their own in a state of solitude, even if they're very happy being alone and think that it's not really an issue for them, they are often vulnerable to forms of insinuation and what would clinically perhaps be called depression, but can have a spiritual and a maleficent dimension to it that we would identify as sort of negative influence from jinn and other creatures that can kind of seek out people who are on their own and not experiencing the social pressures and the benefits of being in a state of sohbah with others. This is an important principle, that solitude, except for the adept, except for the person who really is wearing a suit of spiritual armour and is absolutely in a state of sohbah with his Lord, for ordinary mortals such as ourselves, spiritually very unhealthy to be alone in a state of solitude for a long time, because all kinds of dark things can come to one, particularly, it's said, at night. The adab of associating with others is to treat everyone in a manner that befits his position. A person should be respectful towards his elders, friendly with his peers, and kindly disposed towards those who are younger than he is. He should consider his elders as his father, his peers as his brothers, and those junior to him as his children. It is not proper for a young person to speak in the presence of his elders unless it is absolutely necessary. Even then, he should pause for a while before speaking to enable his elder to finish what he had been saying. Then he should ask permission to speak, and sitting down respectfully, say what has to be said. The young person should by no means contradict his elders, or argue with them, or interrogate them, for the one upon whom the benevolence of the elder radiates experiences the fulfillment of his wishes, both in religion and in the world. It is considered proper to make some request of him, but a disciple should not come and sit at the head of the carpet in the presence of his elders. He should be engaged in serving them. The precondition for association and brotherhood is in living with others. Each should hold it as lawful for another to have authority over his goods. And this is something that's specific to his community. And is a recollection of the principle of Mushatara, which was what happened when the Muhajirin reached the city of Medina and were given a share in the Ansar's homes and property. That's a very high degree, and it's something that isn't incorporated into Sharia for us because it would be really difficult for us to manage. But at the high degree of people who are living as small, devoted communities in a state of Sokhba, very often you will see that they kind of assume whatever they have is the property of others as well. This is a form of life that's almost disappeared now, but in traditional scholarly communities, you can see it in the deserts of Mauritania, you can see it in some places still. The assumption is that everything that is in the academic community or the spiritual community really is held in common. Now, what he's saying here is something that, again, to our generation is strange, this really very strong idea of respect for elders. And the modern world, which inverts so many things, has been particularly insistent on inverting this. It's the fitra, it's human nature, to have respect for those who are older and more experienced than oneself. And one sees this even in the animal kingdom. If you look at whales, for instance, the older whale is the one who is deferred to by the younger whale. This is just the fitra of living creatures. This is normal for us. And I think also that the young crave. Because what young people, and particularly young males, need is older mentors who can initiate them. And some of you might conceivably remember a New Age classic called Iron John by Robert Bly, who's a kind of men's guru. And much of what they do and believe is rather absurd. But the basic principle of the book is a sound one, and one that all traditional cultures, including certainly primordial ones, would recognize, which is that the young person, the young man, particularly the adolescent, has a metabolic need to be initiated in the mysteries of the older male peer group, has to be shown how to hunt for the first time, has to go through initiation ceremonies, has to know how to live in the wild and deal with the dangers of the desert, the forest, whatever it might be. This has always been part of one of the rites of passage of young males. Not so for women, generally, because for women the rites of passage are to do with the onset of fertility and are something that happen anyway. It's something that is in the fitra of women. But rites of passage for men have to be, as it were, artificial and generated by other men in the community. And this, it seems to me, is one of the reasons why in modern societies that are far from the fitra, delinquency overwhelmingly afflicts males rather than females, and why delinquent forms of sohba are overwhelmingly associated with young men and adolescents. Who's badly behaving on the streets at night? 9 times out of 10, it's going to be men. Who throws bottles on the terraces at football matches? 9 times out of 10, it's going to be men. And so on. This particular type of delinquency is a modern phenomenon. Traditional societies have no idea what you're talking about if you say teenagers are so difficult. The assumption is always that the teenager, as he learns through sohba these social rules, is somebody who's quiet and who serves his elders. What else does a teenager do? The modern idea of the teenager as a kind of outrageous rebel is simply not understood at all if you talk to people who are from fully traditional societies. Hence the old Arab saying that al-walad wa-saban malikun wa-amir, a child for its first 7 years is like a king and a prince. Thumma saban abdun wa-asir, and then for 7 years after that is a slave and a prisoner. Thumma sab'an rafiqun wa wazir, and then for the next 7 years is a friend and a pity. And that's how Muslim societies have generally understood the process of growing up of young boys and men. 7 years when they're little kids, they mess around and one is indulgent with them. And then they are like servants. They're the ones who are doing the work at home and fetching and carrying and running errands and buying the books and whatever it might be, that's what they do. And then from 14 to 21 or so, there's a kind of fellowship and a partnership, and as they grow into man's estate, and they become like their fathers, and they are initiated into the practices and the habits and the rites of the full adulthood. That's how it always was. In modern societies, the women generally progress and tend not to exhibit outrageous forms of behavior. Although sometimes now you see binge drinking cultures and forms of criminality amongst women much more than were once the case, but it's still a lot less statistically. The number of women in prison is a tenth of the number of men in prison. The reason for that has something to do with this mystery of Sohba, that the woman is initiated by her biology and by what she is, and she's not worried about growing into being a woman. But the man has more issues, and the male initiation generally in our cultures is lacking. The man who leads the 12-year-old out into the jungle and puts him through some terrifying initiation ceremony no longer exists. Because the physical aspect of life in which men with their strength have traditionally excelled has for most of us been taken away or reduced to a form of entertainment or trivial competitive activities, mock survival activities in the world of sports, which is not really a proper initiation at all, because it's make-believe. When you're playing tennis with somebody, you're not really beating them because the rules are so artificial. So this is something that's important for our culture, and one of the signs of the decadence of modernity is that respect for elders as initiators, as examples of the kind of people that we can see ourselves as being a few decades down the line, is simply nowhere on the horizon or in the conversation of young people and teenagers. And instead, the culture of the young, particularly the male young, is to poke fun at the old. And again, there's a gender differentiation here. The teenage TV shows that poke fun at the old and explain how uncool the old are and how they have obsolete values, 9 times out of 10, it's older males rather than older females that are the object of the mockery of that particular culture. But it's now more or less ubiquitous. This is how we've become. And one of the tasks of sound religious communities has to be to recover what for Makhdoom Saab is certainly axiomatic, the real reverence of the young for the old, which is in the fitrah, but which, because we're so far from nature and so far from our natural selves, has been disastrously lost sight of in the modern world. And how exactly we recapture that is an important issue. But for Muslims, there are rites of passage and there are ways in which one grows to manhood, and the beginning of religious taklif and the obligation of prayer and starting to fast as an obligation is a sign of that. And this summer, for instance, my 14-year-old boy was amazed to discover that he could be the mahram for his mother and take her on Umrah, Mecca and Medina without my being present. And that was actually very good for him as he started to realize that he was growing into somebody strong who would be committed to be responsible and took on some of these takalif sharia. But in a secular modern context, there's absolutely nothing. There's no way in which growing specifically to manhood is something that is respected and confers certain privileges and responsibilities. Let's just move to the end of the letter now. O brother, if you want to sit in the tree of the hidden garden and enjoy the life-giving water, its running streams, as well as trample underfoot the 7 heavens, you can pass in a moment from what is transient to what is eternal by closing the 5 doors of your desires and changing the clothes of this world of calamity and this house of rebellion, just as an oyster in the sea, through the compulsion of longing for you, becomes deaf and blind to all that is not Allah. And then he gives another couple of examples. What is needed is a falcon which after escaping the snares led by the shaitan in this world, can set out towards the world of purity, just as a bird would fly when released from the snare, its heart in tune with its flight with its thinking with the divine secret, and the divine secret will attune it to obedience to Allah himself. And this happened to the chosen one, who in a single stride was in the Mosque of Aqsa, and in another traversed all the heavenly stations, arriving at the highest degree of nearness to Allah. And the wine of union was bestowed upon him. He obtained marvellous revelations. Passing beyond the pale of both worlds, he found repose with his friend. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. That's the end of the letter. That's just one of these 100 letters, and each one is on one of these classical principles. But what one finds when one reads these ancient texts, and he was writing this in a very different place 800 years ago for people really quite unlike ourselves, is how timeless these basic human insights are. Because although we can often feel that we are a different kind of humanity, that people of medieval times were utterly unlike ourselves, in fact, when you read these texts and you see how relevant they still are, because we still have bodies and we still have souls, we still have minds, we still have spiritual aspirations, that in fact the core teachings of religion are unchanged, and a voice like this writing from 800 years ago can still affect us and in fact seem really helpful, because we all have to deal with this issue of sohbah. Who do I associate with? What is the reason for my keeping company with others? What is my niyya in forming certain associations with human beings? What should be my adab with people who are younger than myself, people who are older than myself? All of these are timeless human decisions, and these timeless human values that Makhdoom Sahib is reminding us of here are no longer social norms, but present themselves as gigantically relevant because they seem to be a potential way out of the current social chaos that is causing so many people to suffer from things like prolonged solitude, so many really lonely people, relationships not working too well, people being on bad terms with their parents, people having problems with their children, all of these classic issues that are really spoiling people's lives nowadays, and everybody's afflicted by some of them, sometimes by all of them. There is a solution. And the solution is to have a wise understanding of why we keep the company of others, what should be our adab with certain types of others, and always, most importantly, to have the right niyya when forming any kind of relationship. Wallahu a'lam. That's it. I don't know if anybody's got any questions. Yeah.
This is a stupid question, but it's like silly, it's not like theological or anything, but like, you know how like we Muslims are allowed to relax and kind of have some downtime, mm-hmm. So what would you say is like an Islamically acceptable way to like be with your friends, like as a student, yeah, and have some downtime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Ibn Abbas, for instance, who was known as a really austere hadith narrator and zahid, used to say, إِنِّي لَأَشْتَتِلُ بِبَعْضِ الْبَاطِلِ لِأَلَّا يَمَلَّ قَلْبِي عَنِ الْحَقِّ. I preoccupy myself with some kind of batil, useless things, so that my heart will not be bored of the truth. If you're constantly saying, the best thing I can be doing is to be praying and fasting and reading texts, if you try and do that 24/7, eventually even the beauty of these spiritual things will become very difficult and even disagreeable to you. So it's certainly the way of the ulama is to have a downtime and to relax. And traditionally, that takes place in the context of marriage. That's what marriage is. That's the private side of the believer, and that's where he kind of unwinds and relaxes and takes it easy. If you're not married, then the solution is to get married. If you're not quite at that point, then there's plenty of halal ways of relaxing, chilling out with good friends and doing things that are harmless. The occasional harmless computer game is not going to do you any harm, and sports and so forth. And part of the beauty of the Sunnah is that Medina was not a monastery. It wasn't as if they were being taken away from any kind of worldly thing. Medina was beautiful. There were people engaging in farming, people riding horses, they were practicing the jihad, they were, you know, wrestling in the mosque, and it was probably quite a tranquil existence compared to our hectic modern sort of work from 8 until 7 schedule that so many people are into. Things were quiet. It was a very quiet place, and people relaxed a lot, as everybody did in traditional societies. One of the odd consequences of industrialization has been that we no longer have any time. If you go to very traditional communities who live in deserts or rainforests, and most of the time just kind of sitting around and smoking and talking and playing with their children, now we've got all of these mechanical devices to take away the chores, but we don't seem to have any time. It's interesting.
Talk about the being robbed by modern society of a jungle to go off and be masculine, in, as it were. But that's not a new thing. Surely that comes with urbanism, which is a good few thousand years old, and that it's often always the person who's doing the best out of the complex urban society who is the least exposed to any kind. So to what extent does, I suppose the masculine thrive on the anarchic and the uncertain, because certainty would seem to belie, say, the jungle. That
there are urban forms of initiation in medieval societies, such as joining a guild, for instance, and various tests that you had to pass before you could join the guild, and all kinds of menial tasks that you had to perform for the first 2 or 3 years of an apprenticeship. In the context of scholarship, the sacrifice that you make in order to serve the community and to serve the teacher, and really to be reverent and respectful to the teacher, is also a kind of initiation of young people into the world of adulthood. It's not intensely physical, but nonetheless it's there. In the modern context, it's been almost completely lost, because there is no sense. In Cambridge, for instance, what kind of real adab is there for the senior professor? And very often professors now try to be cool with young people, like using the jargon and sort of hanging out in the pub. There are some exceptions, but the idea that it's an axiom that somebody older than us is deserving of real reverence and veneration, and you carry his books and you do menial things for him, is not really common. But you're right, with urbanization, the sort of primordial forms of initiation are left behind. But there is still a very strong sense that the teenage years are a time of service and sacrifice and being progressively initiated into certain things. And not just initiated into guilds, but initiated joining a madrasa, joining some kind of futuwa fellowship would be very important in the medieval period. And I don't know what people can join nowadays.
ISOC.
Freemasons. Yeah, initiation ceremonies.
Arrow shooting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What?
They've got arrow shooting here.
They do, they? Yeah. I haven't come across.
Mom, you said about socializing with people who would might have negatively affect your faith. What about you positively affecting people by associating with people who are not very religious or kind of not the other way around?
Yeah, but you have to know yourself very well and to be sure that you're going to be doing them more good than you're going to be doing yourself harm. And that's the way of the awliya and the great scholars. They're always hanging out with ne'er-do-wells, and the company that some of my East African teachers took was kind of hair-raising. They would go and talk to prostitutes and people who were drinking and gambling and hang out in the cafes with a little glass of Coke in front of the sheikh while everybody else was getting drunk, and you know, the Sharia issues there, but that tends to be what they do because they have a love for people and they want to get them out of their situation. But if I started to do things like that, then I'd probably immediately start to succumb, I guess. My would be pulled down. So it's a question of self-knowledge. The fact that you might be pulled down if you try and help people who are in a bad situation is not an excuse for not trying to help them. But permanently keeping the company of a substantial group of people who are engaged in bad stuff is a bit dubious. going to do dawah in the pubs, for instance. It's not something we're going to do in Cambridge. There's other stuff that needs to be done first.
I think also I respect that the young people with the fact that some Sahaba and Tabi'in, what we saw at a very young age, teaching older people or would propose certain things that older people would do.
Yeah, that's true. It's not just a question of age. It's a kind of combination of age and respectability and knowledge. And it's an interesting question. I often wonder what should be the adab of somebody who's my age, for instance, to a 20-year-old who's a really remarkable person, who's a harpist and a scholar and teaching in a mosque, and what exactly is the relationship there? And the other person also sees that there's a kind of paradox, and usually people work it out, but it's an amusing issue. And in some Muslim cultures, it's very, very... Some Muslim cultures, it is done largely on the basis of age. So in Turkey, for instance, when you meet somebody who's roughly your own age, you actually have to ask, how old are you, so that you know what form of the language to use. Otherwise, you're being rude to somebody. And then the question is, do you use that older respectful term when you're giving a taxi driver directions, for instance? And all kinds of social niceties come into that, which I'm never very good at resolving exactly. But, what should be the adab of the 70-year-old who doesn't know very much to the 25-year-old who's a great scholar? You see that with people like Habib Ali al-Jifri, for instance, who's really a lot younger than me and a lot younger than most people even in the Middle East, but he's a sheikh and Ahl al-Bayt and full of nur. And it's interesting to see how old people actually kind of defer to him while retaining dignity of their age and how he responds to that. One more question. Okay.
Can you talk about some of the terms, how it's only really good to be for an artist that is able to be able to have time before the desires for that thing? But isn't it tricky sometimes about being as well? Because even if you want to become a good people, you can look at all the time, what you have to do in these sensitive situations, because you look at all the time, you realize the discrepancy and that you're actually maybe decreasing your iman because you look at all the time. You know, and sometimes you need to be alone to resolve the situation and get back to where you were before. So how would you like to do that?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it depends to some extent on the individual. There are some people who do need their own space and need to be alone sometimes, and that's just a need that they have, and it's going to damage them not to do that. But in most societies, until recently, nobody had a room of their own. You know, the Virginia Woolf novel, Women Finally, women had rooms of their own and could be individuals and express themselves, but usually people lived more or less constantly in company with others, and I think in most cases that was benign. Because we do tend to do less impulsive things when we're on our own, and the thoughts are kind of undisciplined and we become very self-involved. Okay, just a question.
There are so many narrations on having detachment from the world and being a state of after the Prophet said that it's a very close to the day as well, like it's the same thing, what the death is, God is to us. When you take that alongside having love for Allah and apply that to being with people and doing things in the world, how does one strike a balance in that state? What sort of emotion should we go into so far with realizing that we should be
Well, it's not insignificant. There's nothing wrong with dunya. What's wrong is our unbalanced preoccupation with dunya. Dunya is Allah's creation at its signs. It's a mass of signs. And the believer is the person who is actually strongly embedded in Dunya, but with the right intention and giving thanks for everything as a gift. Dunya is dangerous when the shukr becomes attenuated and something that we don't feel very often. But the real believer is the expansive person who's smiling and laughing and with other people and isn't really interested in stuff, but takes his pleasure in more abstract things like prayer and conversation and beauty and experiencing the miracle of consciousness, rather than being preoccupied with stuff for what it is. And real human happiness usually comes about through relationships, not through having dunya things. Two people can be absolutely poor, but if they're totally in love with each other, they're the happiest people around. Whereas somebody who's a billionaire is having difficulties with his family is going to be pretty miserable. So dunya in itself is the best of means to an end. But the real happiness comes about through sohbah, human engagement. Okay, barakallahu fikum.